In the first part of my special chat with Jack Fitzpatrick, former Melbourne and Hawthorn player, he talks about his great mate Tom Mitchell, free agency, the influence Dean Bailey had on him, and much more. And it's coming up right now on the Lace Out Podcast. I do appreciate taking, you know, just a couple of moments of your time just to go through a bit through what you've gone through, if that's all right.
Absolute pleasure, mate. Happy to help out.
No, I appreciate it. So first and foremost, I'll do the official welcome to Lace Out, which is the number one unofficial podcast out here at Taylor's Hill. Thank you very much. Now, just a quick question for yourself. How did you feel getting a bit of a mention last night on the Brownlow telecast? Was that something that you didn't expect coming? Because it was probably one of the last names I would have heard popping up in a Brownlow medal speech.
Yeah, so I obviously went with Tom last year. He's a good friend of mine, despite the fact we only played together for one season. His first year at the Hawks was my last, but we got along pretty well. And he dragged me along last year as his dad. It was a really good night. And I actually didn't hear the mention myself. Well, I was at another commitment, but obviously knew that Tom was a massive chance, and as such was very keen to get there and celebrate with him after he won. So I was actually in the Uber whilst he was having his acceptance speech, getting myself the crown. So I didn't actually hear it, but my phone went off pretty quick and heard that, he gave me a bit of a plug. So, something about, you know, I would say that he'd traded down, and most other people would say he'd traded up. So I've only met Anna a couple of times, but she's actually a really nice girl and really good company. So it was good to have a bit of a laugh with them afterwards.
Well, I think the main thing I got out of it, just having to listen to his speech, etc., he seemed very, very humble, down to earth, etc. But for the fact that, you know, you've known him for 1 year through the hit season, that must say a lot about the person that you are. For him to say, hey, listen, I can take anyone to this event, come with me.
I suppose we just got along really well and we hit it off, and you know, I still stay in contact a fair bit, and we catch up when we can, and we want to catch up as often as we like, just with conflicting schedules and whatnot. But we certainly talk most of the time, and you know, I was talking to him most of yesterday, how he was actually feeling, and it was good. He was honest. He said, "To be honest, I'm pretty nervous. It's going to be a big night, and there's a lot of pressure going in, and being such a short price favourite as well. So I think he dealt with it really, really well." From pretty much halfway through the year onwards, and he was able to enjoy the night afterwards, but he also had a lot of media commitments to do today, so he wasn't able to relax too much.
Yeah, and that's the sort of thing that you keep hearing from the Brownlow, the media, etc. Is you do want to enjoy it and embrace it, and a lot of times you do get the winners, unfortunately, might be playing on the Saturday, so they can't enjoy it as much as they want. But yeah, the amount of commitments that Carbine Club, especially a lot of the AFL-sanctioned events, you can't let your hair down. So it's going to take him probably to the end of this week to be able to go, season's finished, let's have that opportunity just to debrief and just, you know, soak it in for all it's worth. Because it's a massive achievement, massive achievement.
It's huge. And one thing that was interesting was he won the Lee Matthews Award as well for the AFL MVP, which was voted by the Players Association, and he actually did say to me over the last week that was as big an honour, if not a bigger honour. And I think you hear a bit in the media, he sort of gets talked down a little bit, despite the fact that he obviously gets the ball so much that, you know, some say he doesn't use it well enough, and he's a very good player, but he's not quite in that elite bracket. And I think he was very proud that, obviously, he polled so well last year with his 25 votes or whatnot. So I think it's almost like, yeah, he didn't win, but you already got the recognition from the umpires for degree last year. And it was only, you know, Danger and Dusty last year had such phenomenal seasons that beat him. Whereas winning the AFL Players Association MVP this year, I think he was really proud of that. But, yes, I actually am respected and rated by my peers, which is obviously, the guys who probably know more about the game than anyone else, the ones who are actually playing against. So he was certainly really proud of that. And last night, I think, the Brownlow is the next level again. It's not so much about the respect and the recognition, but it just changes your life. You're forever a Brownlow medal winner. It's the one night that I remember as a kid, I was able to stay up late from school if it wasn't on school holidays and yeah. watch the count, and you know who the Brownlow medalists are and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's the one event that people, whether they're massive footy fans or they're not massive footy fans, will actually watch. So, yeah, it's a massive, massive achievement. I couldn't be happier for him because he really is a hard worker. He's disciplined and he's a really, really hard trainer. And I think he made mention in his speech that I did see that now he's shacked up with lovely Hannah, who's certainly eating a lot better as well.
So, yeah, I was sitting there going, you know what, when I was playing footy for good old East Keeler many, many years ago, yeah, that was almost my pre-game. Not the barbecue shapes, I was more of a pizza shapes type of guy, but it was, you die. He's, at that stage, you just think, does it really make that much of a difference? But for him to say, look, this is what I was doing, and this is what I was probably playing okay football, to then having to do this, yeah. how much of a difference it can make. Like,
yeah.
To hear that, it's, and then you sit back and you look at it, whether it's a local level, VFL level, whatever, that extra 1 or 2% people aren't willing or committed to do, but it makes a massive difference at the back end.
And I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's only that extra 1 or 2%. And people would say, well, to be honest, like, you look at his season last year, he broke the record for the most possessions had in a year for an AFL player. I think only Matt Crouch beat it because he played finals, but Tom certainly beat it for the home and away season. And then you sort of look at it and go, well, mate, do you even need to get better? Like, surely I don't think anyone would criticise him as being happy with where he was at as a player, but he certainly improved again this year. He found a little bit more of the ball. He certainly kicked more goals, and I think he did elevate himself from one of the better players in the comp to, being recognised as the AFL Players Association MVP, the Brownlow Medal winner, nearly won Coaches Award. So, he's right up there now. And I think that just shows that, yeah, he really wanted to take that next step of just a couple of percent is all it is. And to get that extra couple of percent, as I said, he trains extremely hard as it is. So what are those other things you can do that take you from 95% to 98%, I suppose?
Yeah, and you're exactly right, is it? I think that makes a difference. And you'd know some of the players that you've played with over the years, because you started over at Melbourne back after 2009 draft pick 50, and you would have seen back at the D's and then moving on to Hawthorn, because I want to find out the differences, when you're in the Melbourne system compared to the Hawthorn system, what were the glaring differences that you noticed straight away? But you would have seen players that were talented beyond belief but just weren't willing to do the work, and the results showed.
And I think the best example of this, my point of view, and it's someone I was drafted with, and it's been pretty well documented, is Max Gawn. Yeah. How he's transformed himself. No doubt he was always a very hard worker. He absolutely smashed himself at training and does, really cannot say enough how hard he does work. He's certainly got that, he's a bit of a joker and that light-hearted personality. But when it's time to train, he's always trained hard. But now his diet and off-field stuff and his life, like, he's just really organised and really sorted off-field. And it's a credit to him, because he's, like Tom, he could have just been satisfied with being an AFL player and gone along and had an okay career. And I think Tom, I suppose, in that regard, is very similar in that, he could have been, again, the world complacent, but they just wanted to be better, and therefore they made themselves better. So they're probably both prime examples of, they work hard, but they've really gone that extra level to take themselves to the next level, I suppose.
Yeah, there's a bit of a, I don't think it's an urban myth, I think it's fact, that Gawny went to an NFL game last year and I think had a hot dog, but threw away the bun, just had the hot dog because of the crap that might have been in the bun. Like, that's just, like I said, it's just, that 1% of 1% that can make a massive difference across the
board. Yeah, correct.
I have to ask, so when you joined the D's, you had two people, unfortunately, are no longer with us, which was, I think, Dean Bailey. Was he your first coach?
Yeah, so Bales was my first coach, and Bales was a remarkable person. He was, I really feel sorry for him. He was almost set up to fail in a way, but some of his coaching, he was ahead of his time. And make no mistake, he was a really good coach, not just in terms of a good person, but he knew what he was talking about. And in different circumstances, have no doubt that he would have had a really successful coaching career.
Yeah, I remember because it got down. And look, I couldn't find it, but did you play in the game down at Geelong where we lost by a couple of points, 187? Did you actually get a game that day, or were you in the stands watching it?
No, the funny thing, I hadn't made my debut. My first couple of years under Bales, I actually had quite a few injuries and spent a lot of time playing. But that day, I actually was coming back from injury and played in the VFL twos or the VFL development, which no one exists. So I actually had a really good day and played against Frankston. We won by about 140 points. And I played on the wing of all places and kicked six and got a bit of the ball. So I was happy as Larry. And then at the same time as that game, VFL seniors played against Geelong. And they actually lost by 100 points, which I think gets lost a bit. So I was coming off that game and thinking, hey, straight back into the VFL seniors next week, no issues. Yep. I've played well. And then I went to do a bit of recovery by myself at Amy Park. My game was at Victoria Park. So I went to Amy Park, which isn't too far away. And I heard the game, and I heard Geelong kick the first couple of goals. And then I went in, did my ice baths, and by the time I did the ice baths, had a spa and whatnot, I got back out in the car, and as I was driving home, I heard the score, and I genuinely nearly crashed my car. I couldn't believe it was something, I don't know what exactly it was, but it was something stupid, like 120-10, and it wasn't even half time. And it was a remarkable day. I actually got home and watched the second half, and like, it was hard to watch, but part of me was almost thinking, this is so surreal. I was almost not hoping that Geelong would go on with it, but thinking, like, you never see this again. So how far can this go? Like, it was surreal is the way to describe it. And then I think the weird thing about it was that we got hit by 180 points or whatever it was. And then I reflected and thought, however bad I thought Frankston's reserves were in the VFL that day, because we won by 140, Geelong must genuinely be thinking the same about Melbourne. Like, it was truly a bizarre day, and then weekend that followed. I've never had a coach sacked, and to go through that whole thing, it was very unfortunate for Bales. And as I said, I think he was just sort of almost set up to fail, really.
Because I remember that day, we were playing a game against West Coburg in the league that I was playing, and come out of the rooms, and it was probably maybe 15 minutes into the first quarter by the time you get changed and that sort of stuff, and I'm, Peps, you're already 40 points down, and you're like, what are you talking about? And then you're joking. But then it just kept going. Like, I started getting the text messages myself, being a massive Melbourne guy. And it's like, Peps, you're 100 points down at halftime. I'm like, guys, don't take the piss out of me, please. And they've got the AFL app and the show. I'm going, what is going on? And I think everybody was starting to, you know, leave this game to a degree and go and either watch it or listen to see how big is this going to get. And then
Not wanting Geelong to go on with it, but because it was such a bizarre set of circumstances, you genuinely were intrigued to see where it would end up. It was bizarre.
I think I was more stunned. And then obviously that the news had got out that there was, and if I'm wrong, let me know. If you don't want to go into it, that's fine. But it was like, at one stage they were going to move the CEO Schwab on at the time and keep Bailey, and then this has occurred, and then they've totally flipped on it. And we're sitting there going, hold on a second, this is a coach could not be in control of what's happened on the field, regardless of, it could have been Alan Jeans, it could have been Mick Malthouse, it could have been Clarkson, it could have been anybody. Nothing was going to stop what was going to happen on that day.
Yeah, and I think people forget, like, at that time, we were travelling on a case, we were a game out of the eight, we'd beat Richmond 2 weeks before, at that time we were sort of level pegging with. They were doing their rebuild, we were doing ours, and honestly, I think we were quite a fair bit ahead of Richmond. We won pretty easily by five or so goals. The week before, Hawthorn only just beat us by four or five goals. Like, we were sort of in that game, and if we had beaten Hawthorn, we would have taken their spot in the eight. So this was completely out of the blue, and you're spot on. Like, there's only so much a coach can do, and I don't think it had anything to do with Bales. It was just one of those days that you can't explain. And look, I was only a young player in my second year at the club, so certainly the political side of it I didn't understand or get. But my understanding, and I actually haven't spoken about it with anyone in the know, really. It's just what I've sort of gathered over bits and pieces. So I could be completely wrong, but I believe you're right in that they'd already made the decision they were going to dismiss Cameron Schwab. But after the game, they decided, maybe Bailey we should get rid of. And I actually believe it was Gary Lyon who said, you can't sack both the coach and the CEO. It will almost look like the club is falling apart. So in reality, you just have to make a decision. And unfortunately, I think it was, I guess history shows it was probably the wrong call, and they ended up sacking Bales. So,
and it was almost like it was almost like Gwyneth Paltrow in Sliding Doors. Did she get on the train or not get on the train? And it was, she got on the train, and you know, if it was the other way around, you just don't know what could have happened. But I must admit, I remember watching the press conference that Bales did, and you know. Because that had happened, and then obviously he's been let go, etc. And I'd have to say, out of all the sort of press conferences that I've ever seen with coaches leaving, etc., it was probably one of the most, I'm going out on the high road. And I reckon it even left a bigger imprint on this guy's reputation, just the way he handled the entire situation.
I think the way Bale held himself throughout everything that he had to go through, it just couldn't have been better handled by anyone. And you're right, I think, I mean, I could be wrong, but there almost seems to be this reputation of Bale that it's almost universally accepted. But yeah, you probably didn't know if he actually was a good or bad coach in terms of the people outside the footy club. And I think it's sort of well understood that it's probably poorly done by in the end.
Yeah.
I think that's a generally accepted rule of Bale's. And I mean, I could be wrong, but that's sort of the way I see it anyway.
And I think, if you look at it now, and I think it's, you know, especially where Melbourne are now, and we'll get onto a bit of a differences, and I really want to talk a bit about, you know, some of the stuff that you have gone through with your diabetes, your concussions, and obviously your chronic fatigue, because, you know, when you put all that together, it's a recipe for disaster to a degree. But, I just look at it and go, you know, one of the things that Melbourne had to do before they could get the on-field stuff right is you got to get your house, you know, the back house in order. And as soon as they went and did that with Jackson, and then obviously bringing Ruse, etc., they had to get that side of things stable. And then as soon as that occurred, then the on-field would technically follow. And that's what occurred, because the back-end side of things, regardless of how well they were trying to get things on, I know Jim was trying to do his stuff. They obviously, Gary Lyon was just trying to assist with getting, you know, annealed and that side of things on as well too. But that's just, when it was so, it looked like it was so out, not out of control, but it just wasn't humming along. Then the players have to sit back and go, well, hold on a second, what's going on over there? Or from a playing perspective, like when that stuff's going on through the club, do you feel it resonating through you? Or is it the media who make it more than it is? Or is that,
again, at the time, I was a second year player who didn't really understand the NFL system. I looked up, trained it as I was told, and that was it. But you definitely look back on things and you sort of talk about what's the difference between Melbourne and Hawthorn. And I left Melbourne at the end of 2015 and it had been a really hard time. But at the same time, I think Ruse was on board and the club had started to get itself right. But I left and went to Hawthorn, who had just won their third grand final in a row, arguably the best team of all time. And you go to training and you're going to have people like Mitchell, Hodge, Lewis, Gibson, all these names, Birchall, it just keeps going. The list goes on, Roughheads. And I was almost a bit, not scared or fearful, but genuinely thought, how insane is this training going to be? And what I found was the footy stuff. Melbourne was no worse off in terms of the training standards and how they approach things than Hawthorn. It was just the club itself and Hawthorn, you can see, I mean, they won the VFL Premiership, they won the VFL Women's Premiership after they won the Wooden Spoon last year. They've come back to the top four and admittedly, they're probably just a bit of an easy draw and arguably stand out a bit in finals that they probably weren't as good as, you know, a top four team, but they certainly haven't bottomed out and whatnot. You can just see the club itself is right and it's got good people. And having said that, there's no doubt that Melbourne, in terms of the group, but they're on the right track and you can see that now. And I think even the way that their social media communications team handled the finals, I think Melbourne were excellent. So much exposure, so much insight that fans are able to sort of ride the wave with them. Yep. And I think it's no surprise that now that the club itself is being fixed, and he spoke about the people in charge of that, that the actual football department is able to fully concentrate on football. Yeah. And it's no surprise that that's helped the results on the field.
Yep. So was your first captain James McDonald at the time at the D's?
Yeah, correct. So I had James McDonald, and then we had Fred Green, and then we had the co-captains of Grimesy and Trenners, and then, on to Nathan Jones now. So, J-Mac or Junior, which I always found it weird calling him Junior, which is his nickname, because he was 34 and I was 18. So it wasn't exactly a nickname that I was comfortable with, but... He was my first captain.
Was it because when GWS first started, they got him basically out of a suburban league to go up there and assist with almost like that leadership side of things. When you sort of first heard that was going to occur from your time at Melbourne, could you see the reason why? Because it seems to be that, you know, a lot of people that you speak to saying that he was for Melbourne at that time, it was really good, and when he sort of got the chop for the two young guys, it didn't sort of sit, sorry, I don't think he got the chop, but it didn't sit right when he was sort of moved on with the group of players. And I don't know if that was Mark Neal when he did that, but yeah, it was just...
Yeah, and I think I think it's the general view of Melbourne. They sort of moved people on too soon. And
yeah.
I think James McDonald certainly was moved on too soon. What he could offer the group, he was well-liked, well-respected, not only the way he trained, but the way he went about his football. And we did have a pretty high talented list at the time with so many early draft picks. But just to have been able to have him for another 12 months at least would have benefited that group so much more than getting, you know, five or six games into these highly talented players.
Yeah, yeah. I was speaking to someone who looks after a VFL team or works with one of the VFL on an AFL coaching group, but looks after the VFL side of things. And one of the things, because I was talking to him about what's the difference between, you know, the higher guys and why is it that some don't succeed as much as maybe the lower picks. I shouldn't say lower picks, but mm-hmm. further on down the draft. And one of the things that he said was that when these kids grow up through whether it's TAC Cup or school, etc., because they're so talented, they're just being given the ball time and time again, and they're able to basically do what they want. But when they come into the AFL system, it's not always about having to go and, you know, have the ball fed out to you. They haven't been able to go out and basically go and earn or get their own ball, that they tend to struggle little bit. Is that a fair assessment, or from your experiences of what you've seen?
I think it's just... it's going to sound bleedingly obvious, but sometimes I think the most obvious is the easiest answer. And I think it's easier to play well around better players.
Yep.
And I think the prime example of that is everyone sort of sung the praises of Jack Higgins, for example, of how well he's gone this year.
Yep.
And there's no doubt that Jack Higgins is a very good footballer and will have a really good career. But I think if you were to put him in the... I mean, Brisbane are actually okay, but you put him in... Use Carlton as an example.
I was about to say them, yeah.
He would have done no better, in my opinion anyway, for Carlton this year than someone like a Paddy Dow or whoever their player was. Yep. If you had to put Paddy Dow in the Richmond team, I have no doubt that he would have had a really good first season of AFL football. And I think that's just as simple as it is. If you've got good players around you, your job, you're not carrying as high a load, and you're able to be... come in and be the, you know, the 22nd, 23rd, or 21st, 22nd pick player and play your role, as opposed to these high players who are expected to come in, a Cam Rayner from Brisbane or a Paddy Dow at Carlton or any of these players who are expected to come in and do it themselves straight away. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's why players like James McDonald have been so valuable at Melbourne, because players like Jack Watts came in, Jack Trengove, all these guys were expected to do it all straight away. And unless you're an absolute freak, and there are some, but you just can't.
No.
And you know, it took Hodgie so long to... For how long did you hear Hodgie's no good and they should have picked Jard and this and that? But at the end of the day, he was given time to develop and flourish, and eventually he became an absolute superstar.
And they grow into their role as well too. And I wasn't going to mention Jack or anyone, but you're right. You had Scully, obviously he went, but Trengove, he got injured. You had Colin Sylvia, another high draft pick as well too. Then you had a couple that didn't even. James Strauss was another one who just kept getting injured. Grimesy kept getting injured. You know, but there was a lot of talent on the list, and it was expected that okay, because we've got all these you know first and early second round picks, that that's going to do. It doesn't work that way, because if you have a look at the other side of the coin, which is Hawthorn, they haven't had those high draft picks for goodness knows how many years. It's the development and what you're putting into the players that's where you give them the opportunity. I think Clarkson's put it perfectly, and I think Paul Roos has said it perfectly, is I don't understand why we have to try and rush these kids into playing senior football. Give them a year, give them 2 years in the VFL to develop their game, develop the body, develop the systems, and when they're ready, put them in. Because you know what? We'd been doing it for decades beforehand, and then for some reason it's now, okay, magic wand, you're ready to go. And not everybody has that big build to be able to play AFL in their first season.
Yeah, correct. And I think Alex France played majority of his football in the VFL development when he first started. Luke Bruce played VFL 2s pretty much his whole first year. He's now a you know, an dual Australian premiership player, one of the better small forward in the comp. But I think you're right. It's the word development. And I could go off on a tangent, and it sort of leads into another topic, but that's why I'm really big on free agency, because unfortunately it is a game that it's so short, and unfortunately at the moment there are depending where you get drafted, you have a better chance of your career succeeding as opposed to if you get drafted to another club, and that's just not right as far as I'm concerned. And you name them at Melbourne, and their development for so long wasn't right, and I think now it certainly is. You look at how many good young players they've got coming through and how quickly they're sort of being developed. And I think Brendan McCartney is an exceptional development coach from the 12 months that I've worked with him. But also, he's got the record on the board with all the Geelong players that he was able to work with. But it's just that development. And you name so many players through that era of Strauss, Adam Marek, Jack Rimes, Jack Trengove, Jordan Gisbert, Luke Tapscott, Lucas Cook. I can keep going. Like, there are so many early picks that didn't develop into the careers that were expected of them. But I don't think it mattered who you got in at the club. They just weren't provided the best chance to be the best footballers that they could be. And unfortunately, that's how it was. And as such, you can't have that many early draft picks and stuff them all up. It's that simple. Anyone could have had all of those early draft picks and found some really good players. It's just unfortunate. And I know they did find the good players. Sam Pease is another one. These guys are good footballers. Just unfortunately, they weren't provided with the best chance to develop into the players they became that they should have become.
A friend of the family said it perfectly. Again, he said that. He goes, these kids from an early age know how to kick a football. They know how to mark a football. They know how to play the game. But it's that taking it to that next level where, well, hold on, if somebody's showing me, hey, listen, you don't do this for this particular reason, or instead of doing it that way, try it this way, and other clubs just don't get any of that whatsoever. Obviously, you know, if you've got kids who are, you know, being invested in, they're going to pay it back in spades. But then if you've got, like I said, if the development wasn't there and we're just saying, you guys are awesome, go ahead and be awesome, it's like, well, hold on, how? Like, how can you be awesome at this level? And, yeah, it's...
Correct. And I think, to credit Melbourne, that they're getting it right now. You see how many good young players they've got coming through. James Harms is one. He was a rookie. Oscar McDonald was a late draft pick. Tom McDonald was a late draft pick. All these guys now that weren't the horrible youngsters. Yes, they've got Viney, who was probably going to be a good player, and Clark Oliver was an early draft pick. But having said that, they've just... Charlie Spargo had a really big impact this season.
Certainly.
And he wasn't, you know, a player like this. So, again, credit to Melbourne. They're getting it right now. Yeah. And it shows that with their improvements on the field. But I don't think I'm saying anything. As I said, I think I'm just stating the bleedingly obvious. And what the general, I suppose, perception of Melbourne is in terms of they couldn't get the development right. I certainly think it's a development issue, not a who they were drafting issue. That's probably the one thing I would say, as opposed to so many people would say, oh, they got these draft picks wrong. And I think that goes for any footy club that, you know, they've got. I think Carlton are probably the same. They haven't got the development right. I refuse to believe that they got all of those draft picks wrong. And anyone could, like, you could put Blind Freddy as your recruiting manager with so many early draft picks and just pick random names, and they'd still pick some good players. It's just, unfortunately, the development and the systems there haven't been right. But I'm sure that Carlton are strong in their belief that they've got the right people in charge, and it just might take a bit of time.
Yeah, I think I've said a number of times over on the podcast over the year is that Carlton really needs to look at what Melbourne did. Melbourne went, okay, we can't take shortcuts. We have to do this. We have to do it right. It's going to take a few years to get this right. And
correct.
But when you see the light at the end of the tunnel, it will be brighter than anything you've seen. They've got a great correct. List. They just need to give them time. It's as simple as correct. That. And I think one of the things is that they, you know, they were hoping to get a priority pick, etc. I've also said that that would be one of the worst things that they could get, because sometimes you have to go, no more charity. Let's just we've got to you know, dig the heels in and then just go right ahead and work through this, rather than keep getting that. And I don't like the term, but the charity from the AFL, because you keep going back to that well, and you have to cut it off and just, okay, let's work through this. So to hear that they're not going to get one, but they're still going to get some state league players, which is a bit different, it's good to hear from my perspective.
Yeah, spot on. And I think St Kilda is probably another example, and I won't go for too long because I know you've got another sort of area you want to cover, but I don't think there's any way you can categorize at this stage, say, Richardson cannot coach. I'm sure he probably can coach. They just, things take time, and I'm sure that they've got the players there. It's just, can they make them into the players that were expected of them 2, 3, 4 years ago? Yep. Well, time will tell. But there's no way in my mind that at this stage you can confidently say Richardson is not a good coach. He probably is. It's the development of players. They haven't come on like they should have. Yep. Will they? Well, we're not sure. But regardless of who the coach is, I actually don't think that matters. Anyway, we can move on to the next topic.
No, it's fine, because I think it's... You're right. And you know what? It's almost going back to what we spoke about earlier, is the club can do so much, the development staff can do so much. Do the players themselves want to do that extra to get them up, to get themselves up? And I think you're going to get the ones that will, and you're not going to get the ones that aren't. An interesting point that you just made is when we were talking about the differences. A pick 45 in last year's draft was a gentleman by the name of James Warple.
Now, yep, the Warpedo.
Now, there's a perfect example where you said that, you know, he's picked at number 45. So we're talking, what, third round?
And he's,
depending on. And he's gone into a system where he is surrounded by, you know, Burgoyne, Puopolo, Roughhead, even Sicily to a degree, Stratton, Birch. Like, he's got that nucleus around him to show them the right way. And he's just slotted in perfectly. So
yep.
You're exactly right that it sometimes doesn't matter who the player is. If they're surrounded by quality who is showing them the right things, and this is, yes, this is what you do, this is what it's expected, and this is where you fit in, we just want you to do your role, anyone can succeed. And like I said, this is a guy, you know, pick 45, who didn't look a place out of it. And another one is James Sicily. You know, he was playing down forward, and they're going, this guy, is he a spud? He's gone down the back and turned his career around. Sometimes, yep,
exactly right.
I think we're sometimes too easy to jump on players and say, yeah, they're no good.
We do that far too quickly.
We definitely do
we
it
do
far,
that
too,
far
quickly.
Too quickly.
It's far a cheap too way quickly. Out. Now,
But I think, again, you saw Clarko spoke about it. Warple came in early in the season and he played. And I think he played two games and he was trapped. He just wasn't quite ready. And the system, because Hawthorn's a club, they do things so well. He went back, he was able to play his role and develop into a player at Box Hill in the same system that he'd be playing, and then he came in and all of a sudden he was ready. Now, he's probably one that we really did draft him, because I know it wasn't a high pick, but you see his resume in terms of what he was as a junior player. He captained Geelong Falcons to a flag. He played for Vic Coates. He did all those things. So he clearly was a good player. But again, it's just the fact that he was able to flourish in his role and wasn't expected to come in and have 30 positions each week as a midfielder. He came in and was just playing his role and was able to come in and be that role player as opposed to have to be the best midfielder they've got. So that's where, again, Hawthorn have done it so well, I think.
And you mentioned Clarkson. What was it about? What makes him so revered? I know from a public's perspective, you know, everybody knows Hawthorn supporters. I think he is, you know, four flags, three in a row, obviously a couple of grand finals as well on top of that. But, you know, what makes him just like make people sit back and just go, this guy's got it? I'm not too sure.
From
your perspective.
I think what makes Clarko so good is that he's obsessive about the game, but he sees it so well and he's willing to try things and be different. And, I mean, you know, the way that he sort of reinvented the game with Clarko's cluster in 2008 and the way that Hawthorn played, it's because he's willing to go against the grain and take a risk. And I think sometimes it's probably to his detriment where he'll try things and they don't work. But now, because he's got the runs on the board, he's in a fortunate position where he can try these things and people won't go, oh, he's got no idea what he's doing. He clearly does. He just sees things. And I think, you know, to be honest, I thought the first game that Hawthorn played against Richmond this year, I thought Clarko coached pretty poorly in terms of just what he did tactically wasn't working. And I thought that Hawthorn were quite competitive in that game. It was just tactically they got beat by Richmond. But again, he just was able to try something. And that's why he's so good. He's obsessive about football. He clearly knows what he's talking about. He takes a lot from other sports, whether it be NFL, soccer. He's continually going on his personal development to visit the Premier League clubs or, you know, he did a little Harvard degree whilst he was coaching. Like, he's obsessive about trying to get better. And that's what it is.
It's just someone who just cares for the game, and that's just going to infect people with, well, if he's so passionate about it, if I can take a couple of percent of that and invest that in myself, it's just going to pay back in spades. And, you know, anyone who sits there at a guy's, what was it, 350th game and writes a song about a bloke, like, that's a guy that he loves his football, but he loves his players.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it just seems to be that, yeah. Who got you?
I think that's what he does.
Sorry. That's all right.
No, I think that he is a really good man manager. He understands people. He's able to get the best out of them. And I think you see that with the people he brought in. He targets specific players and gives them a role and not gives them a meaning, but just says, this is what I want from you. David Hale wasn't a superstar. Josh Gibson wasn't a superstar. Brian Lake was a very good player. But to get the impact that he did out of him at the age that he got the impact, identified Sean Burgoyne, identified James Frawley, all these players who, you know, Burgoyne was a star at Port Adelaide, but, you know, that's well known that his knee was probably expected to not last. But the rest of these players weren't superstars, but he just saw a need for them and recruited them. Now, there's been some that probably haven't worked out. People would say that, unfortunately, Tyron Vickery didn't work out.
Yep.
I, myself, was probably a speculative selection. You know, I was a player who spent 6 years at Melbourne, and an outsider's perspective was that this guy can't even get a game at Melbourne regularly. Why are Clarko? Why does Hawthorn want him? But again, they just saw...
In part two, we'll talk about the addiction of playing finals football. If he could put his ideal spine together, who would it be and why? Why is Alistair Clarkson so revered? And how was development such an important part of developing our footballers in the future? Stay tuned for part two of my exciting chat with Jack Fitzpatrick. And as you know, I like my football like you like your football. Lace out.